flat. Oh, 17. 17. And I think there is a matching thing on the test asking you to match all four amendments correctly with their definitions. So we begin with the last bit of material, and there's not that much material to cover, I don't think. So we may end up circling the numbers, and if there's any time left, answering any questions you may have about given items for Thursday's exam. So I guess we start with number 77. I remember feeling like I didn't. I remember feeling like everybody wanted to leave, and I felt rushed. And, okay. Well, think about, before I do 76, think about this. Our history, which we had a little on the quiz there, with Latin America starts in the Spanish-American War, and although there is a liberation of Cuba from Spain, with the Platt Amendment, what happens to that liberation? Even though the Spanish-American War liberated Cuba from Spain, just 3 years later in the 1901 Platt Amendment, how is that Cuban independence adjusted? Yeah, we're a police state over it, in a sense, because we tell them who they can do business with. If you claim you have the right to protect something or somebody, that implies possession, that implies hegemony, if nothing else, is the influence over people. And that's degrading, and that's not treating another nation as its equal in foreign policy. And then, of course, obviously, the claiming and taking and holding on to soil for a military base is an extreme invasive action. How would we feel if, say, for example, say, 1812, Britain took back over part of Detroit or Chicago and kept that as a British military base to the present day? I mean, it's kind of hard to picture because we are the superpower, not the victim. But wouldn't there be kind of a long-running resentment about what is really U.S. soil and some imperial power in our place, even if they said they were going to do it to protect us or something? And so that left bad feelings with Cuba. And, of course, others in Central America saw that and realized they were not strong enough to stand up to American power if it was expressed in their direction. Then we see the incident concerning Panama. Yes, they liberate Panama from Colombia, but they do so for self-interest in regards to build a canal. And so that creates another circumstance where after the Panama Canal, there is this feeling that the United States is a big brother imperialist, treating Latin America as they will for their own personal financial interests. Then to make it even worse, the Roosevelt Corollary also in 1904 just says, if anybody has the right to step in and intervene, we will. The Monroe Doctrine had, in a sense, really already said that a century or more before. But Monroe Doctrine wasn't practiced very often. It was almost kind of considered, giving a good example, anybody remember the Carter Doctrine? People almost chuckle when they hear it, but the Carter Doctrine said that any further aggression taken by the Soviets in Afghanistan in 1979 will be met with military force. Well, they already took over the country. There's not going to be any more aggression after you've already taken it over. But it's Carter's way of trying to act like Truman, trying to say that Soviet aggression in the Middle East will not be tolerated. But shortly thereafter, we started taking care and helping bin Laden fight the Soviets, and so that wasn't a problem anymore. So the Carter Doctrine's forgotten throughout all that time. So a lot of doctrines just kind of disappear in history. The Monroe Doctrine did disappear for the most part. The reason it's studied now is because of the reappearance in the 20th century of our activism with things like the Roosevelt Corollary in 1904. So that, again, communicates this idea that we are, as they would call it, the big brother Yankee imperialists from the North. And then you add to that dollar diplomacy, in which we just say our first concerns in dealing with foreign countries will be to protect our investments, not to protect human rights, not to protect democracy. And if necessary, you might even support a tin-horn dictator who is cruel to his people to protect those investments. So that's why dollar diplomacy, consistent with the commercial interests of and wishes of the United States, helps worsen bad attitudes with Latin America, which we'll talk about how that is affected in the 1930s with the rise of Nazism, because a lot of Latin American countries are very enamored with Hitler and the Nazi movement, and then we have to start backtracking and apologizing and making new policies to keep these people from letting German naval bases be set up in South America. Yes?
I had a question about the Roosevelt Corollary.
Well, I guess it was just because it was the last and the only of, except for British Guiana, Belize and British Guiana were the only two British possessions left in Latin America. So there's no, if they had been building and growing, it might have been something that would have been considered a challenge. But since British Honduras or Belize was established, if I'm correct, in the 18-teens before the Monroe Doctrine was issued. Because I looked that up many, many years ago myself, but I think I found that the date of British Honduras was prior to the Monroe Doctrine. Now, to my knowledge, the only violations of the Monroe Doctrine was Mexico in 1862, and the French took over for 5 years. And I guess if you want to call Russian missiles in Cuba or interference in Nicaragua in the 80s, that'd be the only times that it occurred. And, you know, I often get questions about either Monroe Doctrine or dollar diplomacy or Roosevelt Corollary, that where does this in any way fit international law? It doesn't. It doesn't at all. And in fact, we find that in the Versailles Treaty of 1919, which we'll spend time on, one of the great debates is we don't want to join the League of Nations because it means we'll have to behave by international law, and that'll be the end of the Monroe Doctrine. So that's one of the major reasons we don't join. So again, that sends a signal that we're a country that follows international law when it's to our advantage, and then not always in step with that. Even though, and I'm going to spend some time a little later on this, so I'll just kind of allude to it. When Wilson gets elected president in 1912, and we'll come to that a little bit later, he'll be the first Democrat since Cleveland. And Wilson will try his best to shape foreign policy to say that all this interventionist kind of arrogant attitude towards Latin America is a Republican Party feature, that we Democrats don't share that kind of thinking and we want to have a more moral foreign policy. And what Wilson finds out, as soon as some banana plantations, copper mines are in danger of being taken over by rebels, the businessmen are all over him to send troops, and he sends them. So dollar diplomacy continues right on through both parties up until the 1930s. Well, let's get to how Wilson gets elected now, number 77. As you recall, back in 1910, Roosevelt, only 2 years out of office, maybe 1 year and a half really out of office, has already announced his intentions to seek the presidency for a third term. Aside from just the fact that Roosevelt always had to be the show, what other reasons did he have? Yep. Yeah, he had the visit from Gifford Pinchot and others who'd informed him of Taft's being just a tool of the conservative elite parts of the party. Felt like the country is calling Roosevelt to come back and be the steward and save people and guide people. So it didn't take much, just drop of a coin to get him back. And there's that famous phrase, "My hat is in the ring," meaning he is going to seek the 1912 nomination, which he does. He comes back and seeks to become the Republican Party candidate. One of the things Roosevelt either forgot or never really understood was that the only reason he was reelected in 1904 is because the party couldn't stop him. The party didn't want him to start with. They didn't want him running for re-election. He was just so popular, there was no way to prevent him. Now that he's out of office and there's a sitting other Republican President Taft, it's very easy to prevent him. We find one of the progressive measures that takes place for the first time in 1912 are primary elections. I mean, there's state primary elections as early as 1902 and 1904, but presidential primaries get their start in 1912. They won't be binding, and in fact, does anybody know, I'm not even sure if I know the answer to this, when primary elections become binding? So that whoever wins that primary election gets those delegates for sure. I think in 1972, after that huge mess in Chicago in 1968, that situation so shamed the Democratic Party that both parties in 1972 redrafted laws saying that if you, like for example today, if you win the Iowa caucus and the New Hampshire primary, and I guess Nevada is coming up next, and Arkansas and California are all going to be Super Tuesday real soon. If you come in first place in those presidential primaries, all the delegates of that state are committed to you. So it's kind of a winner-take-all on the delegates. They don't split up. And which it has not since the 1930s, but if it turned out to where, like, say it's Democrats, and say Hillary Clinton and Obama and Edwards, all three win different states to the point where they all split the votes up in three different directions, and nobody has 2,100 or 2,700, whatever it takes to win, what happens at the convention? When you first get there, all the delegates have to cast their votes according to who won their primaries. But if nobody has the majority needed to get the nomination, then when you go to a second or third or fourth ballots, all those delegates are free agents. They're no longer committed to who won the primaries. So then they could all move over to Edwards or Clinton or whichever. And that's when politics used to be a lot of fun, because that's where the behind smoke-filled door rooms, all kinds of deals were cut for who gets what to get these delegates on their side. We hadn't seen one of those since the 1930s. The one that made the big attention was in 1968, when Hubert Humphrey entered no primaries, won no delegates, and still on the first ballots got nominated for the presidential party, candidacy in 1968, in the midst of all that riot taking place about protesting Vietnam. So that's what made the party still look so corrupt, that they wanted to reform it to say that delegates won in primaries actually do count on the first ballot. Well, they didn't in 1912, first primaries. So even though Roosevelt won a whopping majority of all the presidential primaries, the party still nominates Taft, which just reinforced for Roosevelt exactly the problem here: corruption during the progressive movement. And he's unwilling to give his support to the party. He says, I'm thinking of running as a third party candidate. Who's with me? And a sizable chunk were. A sizable group of Republican progressives, calling themselves insurgents, bolt from the party, refuse to accept Taft. They hold a separate convention. Roosevelt's, of course, the whole purpose here is to be president, is championing himself as the leader of progressivism. Robert La Follette, who we talked about earlier in the quiz, makes a great strong stand about saying that since he is the pioneer of progressivism, he should be the candidate. And everybody tells him. They don't even know you on a quiz. You can't win. So therefore, he's passed over and Roosevelt gets nominated. They call their party the Progressive Party. Roosevelt, when asked how he felt about the race, said he felt fit as a bull moose, ready to run. So they started portraying him on campaign posters with antlers and looking like a moose. And eventually the party itself changed its name to the Bull Moose Party. So if there was ever a chance for a third party movement to unseat the two major political parties and win the presidency, this one was seeming to be it. He was so much more popular than Taft, as Republicans split and more Republicans are going to Roosevelt in this third party movement. So we have Taft the Republican, Roosevelt the Bull Moose Progressive, and then Democrats who see a chance to win. I know you're thinking, does William Jennings Bryan want to be candidate? Yes he does. He thinks, I can win this one. And they say, we think we can win too if you're not there. I mean, the Republicans are shooting themselves in the foot, and if you're out of the way, we can win this. Will you please do us the favor of not running? And finally, begrudgingly, says, only if I get to choose the candidate that does run. William Jennings Bryan.
The one that ran 3 other times.
Yeah. Is this not the image of Bryan you want to have? I'm sorry. So Bryan says he's very, very impressed with a first-term New Jersey governor, Woodrow Wilson. Also, Bryan says, in addition to choosing the candidate, of course there were primary elections, but I mean he was chosen to be the one that primary elections are supposed to want, and they did. In addition to that, he says he wants to have the most prestigious of the cabinet positions, Secretary of State, which he will get after Wilson wins. A little bit of biography on Woodrow Wilson. Like I say, he was only in his second year as a elected politician, as governor of New Jersey. He's the only president to have a PhD, getting it in history. And he, like so many other history instructors, think that their idealistic dreams, that they could just, somebody would listen to them, they could save the world, and that was, and I understand that. Wilson felt that way. He was born in Virginia, and his Virginia, not now, but then, roots stayed with him as Woodrow Wilson was flamingly racist as well as sexist. Sometimes that's called being a man of his times. Wasn't the only one. But went into teaching college at Princeton University. And while he was teaching history at Princeton University, he was offered the chance to have the presidency of the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville. And he blew it. He passed it up. And from there, it was a downhill slide. His consolation prize was to become president of Princeton University, then governor of New Jersey, and finally president of the United States. But he had a chance. And he considered it for a while. So moving from academia, it was this classic progressive thinking that if you get someone who's a trained expert in the field of political science, which he felt himself to be, having studied the British parliamentary system and compared it to the American constitutional system in his dissertation, that the Wilson belief was, as a trained political expert, I'll be able to run government efficiently and in response with the wishes of the people democratically. So when the electoral vote is cast, he wins, as it shows here in 79, 324 electoral votes to Theodore Roosevelt's 88 electoral votes, which is, I think, still to this day the highest polling of electoral votes by a third-party candidate. The next one is 69 votes by George Wallace in 1968. To Taft's 8 electoral votes. You're thinking, what a sting and what a shock it must have been for the Republican candidate to win only 8 votes. Well, he's not the only one to feel it. In 1936, Alf Landon of Kansas got 8 electoral votes to FDR's 523 votes. So, when you look at some of the 72 Nixon race and 84 Reagan race, that's almost in reverse what happened to the Democrats. But in this case, it happened to Taft, 8 electoral votes. So a clear victory for Wilson. In that campaign, everybody had, well, Taft didn't, that helps explain his losing. Two of the candidates had their campaign slogans and their programs in place. Wilson's was known as the New Freedom, and it was a Democratic Wilsonian view of what progressive measures needed to clean up the country. Roosevelt, back to him a little bit, who had originally expounded the idea of the square deal, which his cousin would later steal and call the New Deal. Roosevelt had moved to now what he called the New Nationalism. And that's not on the sheet, but I want to talk a little bit about it. The 1912 Roosevelt, compared to the 1902 anthracite coal strike mediator, such a contrast, because if you recall in the 1902 anthracite coal strike event, he was very reluctant to recognize the union. He feared unions in general. In fact, the Roosevelt argument was that if businesses ran fair and played fair, there would never be a need for unions. That unions have too much of a history and a lineage to the radicalism of European anarchism. Very anti-socialist, very pro-capitalist in the early administrations. By 1912, Roosevelt will be the first candidate to advocate national health insurance, full paid college education for all people, all of this through the redistribution of wealth through high income taxes. Very much a socialist. I mean, he wouldn't admit it, but that's where he's going with it. He always called it a mixed economy advocator. But mixed economy means make it as socialist as you can, except for when you got to have some capitals out there generating some money for tax purposes. That's really what that means. Mixed economist, yeah. In one of his speeches, someone fired a shot at him and hit him. And people wanted to rush him to the hospital immediately, and he demanded that he continue every word of the speech until it was over. And as they hauled him off, he thought, man, this is going to look great, you know, if I live through this thing. Well, it turns out that it hit a Bible in his pocket, never got into him. The Bible stopped the bullet. I mean, that's a sign, isn't it? He thought so. And again, not on the test, but still, I'm going to get the look for that. But still, I think some interest is Roosevelt patterned his 1912 third party campaign after an author named Herbert Croly. Now, he's not on a quiz, not on a test. But the thing I like about this, or find interesting, is Herbert Croly wrote a book called The Promise of American Life, and it's this book that Roosevelt was excited by in the campaign, in which Croly argued we should seek Jeffersonian ends through Hamiltonian means. Well, let's spend just a moment talking about that, because it'll make a lot more sense later when we talk New Deal, Roosevelt 30s. When you make the comment, achieving Jeffersonian ends through Hamiltonian means, this takes us back to the 1790s. What did Hamilton, Alexander Hamilton, what were his ends? What were his goals? Who did he wish to... big, strong national government for the purpose of doing what? Who is he out to help? The wealthy elite, not the poor. Of course, his argument is it's going to help everybody, because if you help the wealthy elite through government programs, it will trickle down and help everybody, generate a strong national economy. So his ends were to help the rich through big government. Jefferson, on the other hand, a rich person himself, always claimed he was out trying to help the little guy, the average ordinary farmer, small yeoman farmer, through small government. Protect the little guy from monopolist power of government by just letting everything a level playing field. So Jefferson's thinking was it takes small government to help the little guy, it takes big government to help the wealthy. Here Herbert Croly puts this into a kind of a reverse spin and says, let's use Hamiltonian means, big government, to help the little guy. And this is where Roosevelt's kind of the first serious candidate to embrace this idea. It's that change away from the Democrats being laissez-faire. That this is, I think, one of the hardest political things to explain and get across is that all the way up till the 1930s, both parties distrusted large government, but it was the Republican Party that was more comfortable with using big government to free slaves and redistribute money. This is exactly what Roosevelt's doing here. He's pushing this notion of using big federal government to help the little guy. And Wilson's New Freedom, it was a reform package that was built around that old-fashioned notion is the smaller government is, the better the little guy is protected. So Wilsonian progressivism was based on how can we protect state governments and hold in check federal authority and yet still be progressive and reform things. Which is why I think earlier when we were talking about the trust buster slogan for Roosevelt, Roosevelt didn't mind bigness as long as businesses and government play fair. Where Wilson's view was all bigness is dangerous, you should break things down into smaller units, letting state government rule. So that's why even though that part's not on the test, I think it's a real critical indicator of where politics are going to change in the 1930s. And if we get the clue as early as 1912, and you might be thinking you'd get the clue as early as 1896 with the populist and Bryan candidacy. Well, Wilsonian laws that are passed in item 81, we see the Underwood Tariff, or the Underwood-Simmons Tariff as it's sometimes known, passed in 1913. Underwood-Simmons Tariff. It's a tariff decrease, as Democrats would perceive tariff reform and progressives, bringing down the rates of the Payne-Aldrich tariff. It has an income tax attached. So did the Wilson-Gorman. Wilson-Gorman's income tax was overturned. Why was this one not? Because now it's legal. Because in 1913, the 16th Amendment has been ratified. So it is passed precisely because it can be legally attached. There is the creation of the Federal Trade Commission in 1914. This will be a federal agency to watchdog industry that prevent them from cheating customers and hurting labor.
What is it called?
Federal Trade Commission. In 1914, there will also be something called the Clayton Antitrust Act. The Clayton Antitrust Act of 1914 will differ from the Sherman Act of 1890 in this way. It will say precisely, farm associations and labor unions are exempt from this legislation. You may recall that in the early years, it was labor unions that got hauled into court rather than businesses. Well, that's not what the law intended to do. The law intended to go after the big guy, not the little guy. And so the Clayton Act is going to literally make it so that only monopolists themselves are the ones who get convicted of this. Labor unions. Farm associations and labor unions.
What?
Exempted them from antitrust legislation. You may recall in the 1894 Pullman strike that Debs and the ARU, American Railway Union, were convicted for violating the Sherman Act through their strike. That wasn't the intention of that law, too. And there was it right in the same year they allowed that wholesale sugar company to go unregulated. The Keating's-Owen Act.
Can you go back for a second? The Federal Trade Commission was established in 1914.
Right. Its purpose was to be a watchdog of industry to make sure that big business and industry do not abuse their workers and customers. I mean, we'll see this thing kind of mushroom out and become multiple agencies and protecting against food and drug and things like that. You may recall, I think I mentioned this earlier, and I don't think it's on the test, but as early as 1903, there was the creation of that Commerce and Labor Department, and now in 1914, it splits into two separate cabinets. Whenever you have more and more cabinets being created, whether it's education or energy, or whether it's Homeland Security or Veterans Affairs, what general trend does that tell us? They don't wipe them out, they just keep adding. So. Okay, there is one that I've forgotten. Has any cabinet position ever been destroyed? Nope, they just stay around and build new ones, right? Even Republicans who say there's too much big government add Homeland Security and they added the Veterans Affair. So if both parties add cabinet positions, or in this case split one into two, I'm thinking twisted maybe here, but what does that tell us? Well, it could be that there's too much power being wielded by the federal government, or it could be that people see problems as no longer manageable at the state level, that it takes national, federal level power to manage national economic issues. So progressivism under Wilson, even though Wilson claimed to be someone who was for letting states have more voice, in this case, it's allowing federal government to grow to regulate the economy. See what else is going on. The Keating-Zoen Act. It is an anti-child labor law. It says products made by children under the age 16 cannot be transported across state lines. Why doesn't it just ban all child labor? Well, because at this point in time, the belief that states, free from federal interference, have the right to regulate child labor. The only way you can do something about setting laws for how old you can work is to make sure that it is where Congress has that interstate commerce control power. So that's why it's set up that way. Our last section of material.
So they can't be transported over state lines?
Right. So you built it and sold it within the state of Arkansas. The feds couldn't regulate it in 1916. But once it crosses a state line, it then becomes interstate commerce, and thus Congress can regulate it. This is the time when there were calls for one of the constitutional amendments to be an anti-child labor amendment. It never made it because these laws substituted instead. 85 through 87 is a look at Wilson's foreign policy in Mexico. And it won't take us very long to get through this. So we said before earlier, and then I'll have time for the numbers here. So I said earlier, Wilson had hoped to try to put forward a more friendly, neighborly type foreign policy with Latin America, because he believed that personally, but he also felt like there was a chance to exalt the Democratic Party as the good party in the eyes of the Latin Americans and the Republicans as the greedy one. And so he puts forward what he calls a moral foreign policy of not intervening, not interfering. This is early in his administration, 1913, 1914. Things in Mexico will test that. As a series of leaders come and go, Porfirio Diaz, who had been elected in the 1870s, but by 1911 was no longer having to run for re-election, he just established himself as dictator, was violently overthrown by Francisco Madero. A close friend of Madero's, Pancho Villa. Madero was the politician, Pancho Villa was the activist. And together they hoped they would be able to, and it's leaning Marxist socialist here. They were going to take the huge haciendas away from landowners and redistribute the land to peasants who had none. Before that could happen, another overthrow takes place when Victoriano Huerta overthrows and kills Madero in 1913. It's the same name. I don't have any idea if it's the connection at all. I'd like to know the translation of what the word means. So,
Madero overthrows Diaz, and then
Huerta overthrows Madero. And in the quick changeover from one year to the next, people in America are deep, or businessmen, I should say, businessmen in America deeply concerned what's going to happen to our businesses down there. There's all, if they're as socialist and Marxist talking as Madero and Villa were, are they going to nationalize the companies, which they actually will do in 1925? Are they going to take over American oil companies? Madero had made no threats in that direction, so that made it easy for Wilson to say, let's watchfully wait, as he said. Sit back and wait and watch and see what happens. Well, when Huerta takes over, Huerta makes much more greater noise about nationalizing American industries. That's where the businessmen start to push Wilson to say, you've got to intervene, you've got to exercise dollar diplomacy to protect our interests. And Wilson's trying his hardest to avoid being pushed until in 1915 he learns from an item 87 down here that a boatload of guns arrives on the east coast of Mexico from Germany. Why would guns in 1915 from Germany be any great alarm? World War I's already a year old. And although we're a neutral still in 1915, it is obvious how much more we favor the Allies and fear the Germans.
Where did the boat show up at?
I think it was Veracruz. That's why I tried to cover my ignorance by saying the east coast of Mexico, and you caught me and nailed me down. I once knew it. If I'd go back and reread all my material, I'd know it. But anyway, so the guns show up. And, of course, later when we study World War I, we'll find out about something called the Zimmerman Telegram, where Germany was in the negotiations of trying to get Mexico to go to war with us. So that figures into the concern. So at that point, if you've got a neighbor in cahoots with Al-Qaeda threatening to take over your oil companies, maybe watchfully waiting is not the best policy. So Wilson then decides to send military forces. Some American sailors who were at that time visiting in the port city of Tampico are arrested by the Huerta government, were already arrested before so the arrest of the sailors preceded the guns. Those two incidents together, the arrest of American sailors, the arrival of the German guns, that's what pushes Wilson to act. While he's getting American forces ready for invasion, Latin American nations, Argentina, Brazil, and Chile, send a message to Wilson saying, wait. You've had a good start here. You don't want to look like the imperialist. We can help you out. Latin American affairs should be solved by Latin American nations. Give us a chance to have a conference and meet and try to mellow things out in Mexico before you have to intervene. Argentina, Brazil, and Chile, known as the ABC powers. So Wilson says, well, fine, we'll even let you have a meeting place in Niagara Falls if you like, make a vacation of it. So they do. They send delegates to Niagara Falls, and they're meeting with Mexican delegates. While this meeting takes place, another coup takes place in Mexico. Huerta is overthrown by Venustiano Carranza. And Carranza is exactly what the United States wants. A person who promises there'll be no nationalization of industry, American investments will be safe, and there's not going to be this radical Marxism of taking all the land and giving it to peasants. Things will go back to the good old days of Diaz.
Is he from one of those three nations?
He's just another Mexican ruler. So the order is going to be Madero overthrown by, Diaz overthrown by Madero, overthrown by Huerta, overthrown by Carranza. No, they didn't. They were about to, but these events took place on their own in Mexico. There's no evidence that we backed Carranza. We were happy with Carranza, but we didn't take a hand. Villa, though, thought like you did. Pancho Villa thought how inconvenient it was that when land distribution was about to take place, a puppet of the American government is in power, and so angry Pancho Villa crosses into New Mexico and raids, I think, Roswell and Columbus, New Mexico, and kills 19 Americans. Takes refuge back in Mexico.
Killed 19
Pancho Villa. The U.S. government sends the General John J. Pershing to catch Villa with Mexican permission, because Carranza's Villa will be coming after him next. Pershing gets deeper and deeper into Mexico, doesn't find him, and by 1917, turning into 1918, is recalled to get American soldiers ready for World War I. And Villa finally dies in the mountains in the 1920s.
Pershing goes after
Villa and never catches him. John J. Pershing, he's going to be better known as the commander of American soldiers that go to World War I. He's nicknamed Blackjack Pershing because he once commanded African American soldiers. And here's another little feature you didn't want to hear. During the Philippine resistance movement led by Aguinaldo, 1901 to 1903, Pershing was one of the generals in the Philippines who was furious at our terrorist tactics. He said that if you treat these people as equals, it'll help quell the revolution. So he was very racially tolerant early on. Yeah, about 1924 or 25. I think he was double-crossed by one of his own parties and given up to Mexican authorities.
So that's all
he did to
World War
I? Pershing, while he is chasing Villa, to his relief, is recalled back to America. Forget the whole Pancho Villa chase. Let's get American soldiers ready for World War I. Yeah. Villa was a compadre of Madero back in the first overthrow. Madero's the politician, Villa's the guerrilla fighter in the fields. They both want to, in a socialistic fashion, redistribute Mexican wealth.
Okay, so the U.S. calls Pershing back
to prepare for World War I. So I guess you could say in the Mexican situation, Wilson was able to follow his wishes, and that is not intervene. Not so easy in Dominican Republic and elsewhere, but in Mexico he keeps it. There'll be more foreign policy situations with Mexico as we talk later that'll make this all have a little more meaning to it. But here are the numbers. Back to the first page. You are the class that has made higher scores than any other class, and you're going to keep that tradition going and make A's on this test, right? Okay, great. 1B. This is page one, of course. 1B, 2, 8, both 8A and B, 10, 11, 12. Next page. 13, 14, 16, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 28, 29, 31, 32. Next page, 38. Be cool to know all those authors in the book titles and their themes. Heard that exhale. 43, 44, 46. 43, 44, and 46. Next page. 52, 53, 57, 60, 61, 64, 65, 66, 69, 72, 74, 75, 77, 79, 83, and I'm saying only 87. I guess it's just 87, yeah. So I think it's all multiple choice and a few matching, very few matching, like maybe 5 or 10, and the rest are like 40 to 45 matching. I mean, multiple choice. Thursday, right. Bring an extra Scantron for the person who doesn't. Mixed economy.